language that everybody here can easily understand.
Just because it's late doesn't mean we're done yet.
And the shirt's up. That's a penalty.
And the quarterback, you kidding me, coach?
There's plenty more hits to dish out.
Well, he really hit the shit out of that one, didn't he? Look at that. He hit the f***ing ball. That gets a free steak.
This is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5. Presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph. Get Physical RX. By Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology. And by BetUS, the original online sportsbook. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's Patrick Creighton. Look in my
Late Hits, ESPN 97.5. This is the only live and local evening sports radio show in the city of Houston. 713-780-3776, 713-780-ESPN on the HRMB listener line, on the text line, on X, Twitter, at PCreighton1. Josh Chavans on the other side of the glass at the master controls, and I am Jay Chevy on the X Twitter. On the Twitch stream, twitch.tv/ESPN975, ESPN975.com, ESPN975 app. Tell Google, tell Alexa, play ESPN975. Take us with you everywhere you go. You know you want to. Always love talking with Sam Khan, The Athletic. You know, there's a lot of very interesting storylines with all the different college football programs. I mean, I didn't even get to ask him about TCU and Texas Tech, because both of those teams are kind of struggling through, especially TCU coming off of, you know, going to the title game. And, you know, they're not even a 500 team right now. Both of those two teams have struggled badly this year. You know, you're like, which one of those teams is going to bounce back first in what is going to be a revamped Big 12 next year? Obviously, no Texas, no Oklahoma. Conference will look different. I also thought it was a great point by Sam talking about how, yeah, UH has struggled this year, its first year in the Big 12. But when you compare them to the other teams that are new in the Big 12, man, maybe they're not struggling as much as you thought, because BYU is also 2-4 in conference. Now, they're 5-4 overall. UH is 4-5 overall. But if you look at, you know, what BYU's schedule looks like, all right, they beat Sam Houston. Come on. They beat Southern Utah. They beat Arkansas, and Arkansas sucks. They lost to Kansas. They got destroyed by TCU by 33. They got annihilated by Texas 35-6. They got destroyed in West Virginia last week 37-7. Their best win might be Texas Tech. You know, so they haven't, you know, been anything to write home about. UCF is 1-5 in the Big 12, and Cincinnati's 0-6. And they've been outscored by nearly 80 points in those six games. They've lost seven straight. I mean, they stink. They're 2-7 overall. They stink. So, Cougs, grand big picture, all the new teams coming into the Big 12, they might be having the best season of all the newcomers coming in. I mean, Texas is ranked 6th or 7th, depending on, you know, which poll you're in. Okie State is 15. Kansas is 16. Oklahoma is 17. And K-State, 20. They have five top 25 teams in the Big 12. That's really good. You got three top 10 teams in the Big 10, and then Iowa at 22. That's it. So there's more ranked teams in the Big 12 than the Big 10. Should I push my luck? There are the same number of ranked teams in the Big 12 as there are in the Pac-12. Pac-12 is a really good conference this year. That's because they're breaking it up. there's only six ranked teams in the SEC. So, you know, the Big 12 has been a pretty good conference this year. I mean, I don't want to poke fun at the All-Cupcake Conference, but they have three ranked teams. And North Carolina's 24. Florida State is carrying the All-Cupcake Conference. Carrying. Though Louisville is also doing their best, but they're down right now. They're down 20-14 for Virginia, which, if I'm remembering correctly, they were up 14-0 like 20 minutes ago. So, college football is going to get very interesting over the next 3 weeks. Coming up next, we're going to talk some Rockets basketball. The resurgent Houston Rockets with our buddy Salman Ali from Red Nation Hoops next.
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Planet Unicorn, hey.
Planet Unicorn, Unicorn Planet.
This is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5, presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph, Get Physical RX, by Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology, and by BetUS, the original online sportsbook. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
All right, joining us right now on the HRMP guest line, he covers the Houston Rockets at Red Nation Hoops. He is our buddy Salman Ali. What's going on, Salman? How you doing?
How you doing, Patrick? I'm doing all right.
Good to talk to you with my friend. How about our resurgent Houston Rockets? I'll tell you what, after the first game of the season, there was a lot of, oh, no, not again. But they have not looked like the same team from opening night. They have gotten better each passing game. What we'll call the Ime effect. How much progress are you seeing, and how impressive has it been to you, the progress this team has made over eight games?
Oh, it's been pretty stark. I mean, their defense, they're the second best defensive team in the NBA over the last four games.
Hold on, say that again. Just say that again.
Yeah, second best in the NBA. They've been fantastic. Their rebounding has really improved over those first three games. They rebounded the ball poorly. And they turned it around after Ime did some drills with them, and it's been pretty crazy how they're just blowing teams out. Like the Kings, what they did to the Kings, that should be stricken from league pass. Like people shouldn't be allowed to see that again. That was violent. It was not pleasant. It was uncomfortable. Like I felt uncomfortable on part of the King. It was bad. They're just destroying teams. Now, granted, some of these teams are coming in with subpar health, right? The Kings without De'Aaron Fox, the Lakers without Anthony Davis, but the Rockets are destroying them. It's not like they're beating them by like 5 points. They're beating these teams by 20, and it's oftentimes the game's over by the time the fourth quarter rolls around.
Yeah, they have been. I mean, they look like a completely different team. And the fact that a team that has played no defense for the last several years is now playing, like, among the best defense, it's night and day watching this team. It is, you know, coming into the season, there was a lot of excitement about the team with Udoka, with the new draft picks coming in. And you know, Amen Thompson is injured, and Cam Whitmore is now he's off to the G League. So the new guys aren't really the ones who are getting it done as far as the draft guys. But Van Vliet, Dylan Brooks has been great.
Yeah, Dylan Brooks has been one of the best value offseason signings of the summer. I mean, he's been worth every dollar the Rockets paid for him. His three-point shooting is probably going to come down to earth a little bit. But defensively, he's really turned around Houston's perimeter defense. Their points allowed in their shots allowed in the paint is down significantly from where it was over the last 2 years. I mean, they're really walling off that paint, and that's VanVleet and that's Brooks. Like they're doing a solid job just kind of insulating Alperen Şengün in the middle and kind of making his job easier, you know, kind of like limiting those attacks from getting to the point where Şengün has to make hard decisions in the paint. And it's really simplified everybody's role defensively. Jabari has played better defensively because of those two. And more than anything, the shooting that those two are providing for Jalen Green and Alperen Şengün to make rim attacks, to make kickouts, it's been dramatic. I mean, the floor is spaced much better than where it's been these past few years. It's just a much cleaner offensive game. They're certainly making a jump defensively on Neiman, but offensively, these additions have really helped them space the floor. And it's a credit to the Rockets front office for, you know, going out and targeting these guys.
Sam, let's talk about a couple of guys who have taken a good amount of criticism regarding their development over the last year, and one guy's case 2 years. Let's start with Jalen Green, because there were a lot of people who were unhappy with the development of Jalen Green last year. People felt that, you know, maybe he didn't progress or he didn't take a step forward. Maybe he took a step back. They just weren't happy with the inconsistency in his game. But last night, I think you got a really good look at the kind of player the Rockets hoped that he was going to develop into when they took him with the second overall pick. He had 28 points in 21 minutes, and it seemed like everything he shot was splashing. He was maybe the best I've seen him look in his entire time. What have you seen from Jalen Green this year, and what are you, I guess, looking forward to him doing as the year goes on?
First of all, you know, you bring up the kind of everyone's expectations for Green, and I kind of, you know, reading, you know, some of the commentary, I felt like the conversation around Jalen had become kind of unnecessarily complicated. Like, he's a third-year player, right? Like, it's going to be rough. You look at some of the guys who's compared to Zach LaVine, Bradley Beal, Devin Booker, Anthony Edwards. Like, if you compare Jalen at his point in his career, when those guys were at their similar point in their career, I mean, he's comparing favorably. In a lot of one-to-one comparisons, he's doing better. And I thought it was kind of unfair to put, you know, lofty expectations for him to come out of the gate, like, really, you know, like averaging like 35 points per game as a rookie. Like, that's kind of unreasonable, right? Like, I think now, so what you're seeing is a player kind of put his game together as a ball handler, coming off the dribble in pick and roll. I think what he's doing off the ball has always been present in his game, but he's just really knocking down that three ball. He's shooting 12 of 21 over the last four games, and he's playing really well off of Fred VanVleet. I mean, Fred VanVleet's really helped him kind of, you know, ease his load as a ball handler. And what the Rockets were doing with him last night was, like, so the Rockets seem to enjoy pulling VanVleet and Alperen Şengün at the same time and leaving Jalen out there. And for the first few games of the season, that was kind of rough, right? Like, having no engine out there to kind of drive the team. But I think it's kind of a development tactic. They want Jalen to drive that second unit. They want him to drive the offense. They want him to drive the team. And last night, like, you know, I was kind of bracing for a drop off there when VanVleet and Şengün went to the bench, and that would happen. Like, Green went off. Like, he absolutely went off. He was making Austin Reeves pay for going under ball screens on pick and roll, and he was hitting all of his jumpers. And that actually, I actually thought his three-point shooting is what opened up his driving lanes. Like they were so scared to go under on screens again that he would just use his elite first step to go past guys who were going over the screen. And that, you know, led to those two acrobatic finishes that we saw there at the end. That one, you know, that one contortion layup and that one and one layup where he hit it in with his left hand. Like, that kind of stuff is super impressive. It's obviously a sign that he's getting much stronger at attacking the basket. But it really starts with his three-point jumper. His three-point jumper looks really, really good right now. I mean, he was a good shooter at the G League, but it's really starting to translate to the NBA level. And that's a testament to his work. He really worked on that this offseason.
Salman Ali, founder at Red Nation Hoops, with us on the HRNP guest line, talking about your Houston Rockets. Let's talk about Jabari Smith, because, you know, he was supposed to be the first overall pick in the draft. The Rockets weren't going to get him, but he winds up falling to the Rockets at three. And I think maybe the expectations for Jabari were unrealistic last year, but you take a look at him, I guess, over his last, what, five games, and he's shooting 50% from three, and he's averaging 15-7, and, you know, and you mentioned about the improved defense from Jabari Smith. What have you seen from Jabari as the season has kind of moved from, you know, the beginning, these first eight games, and where do you see him heading?
Yeah, offensively, actually, I feel like he's really made strides as a ball handler this summer, and you saw that at the summer league. And you were kind of wondering, is this going to translate to the end, to the regular season? It translates to the preseason. And then those first three games, you didn't really see a lot of that. And then last night, you saw possessions where he was going coast to coast with the basketball and finishing at the rim with it. And those are the two elements of his game that I find the most impressive, that, you know, he's been able to improve as dramatically as he has with the ball in his hands. Like, he looks much less awkward out there dribbling the basketball, and that was kind of one of my concerns with him coming out of the draft, but he's really worked on that. Like everything you hear about Jabari is that he's a hard worker, and all, you know, he takes in criticism pretty well, and you're seeing his confidence, that confidence he showed at Auburn when he's shooting the basketball, you're seeing it translate to the NBA level. The three-point jumper is going down. You know, there was no question that he was eventually going to turn it around a little bit, but he's really starting to get to that elite territory in terms of three-point percentage. And really, like, his role is simplified. You know, he doesn't have to be Auburn Jabari. He can just play off of these guys who are really having it, who are really taking the work off his plate. You know, Auburn Şengün, Jabari Smith, not Jabari Smith, Jalen Green, Fred VanVleet. These guys are taking the offensive burden, and he can kind of play off those guys and pick and choose his moments to handle the basketball as he pleases. And in those moments, he's looked much more polished. And it's really impressive to see.
Salman Ali, Red Nation Hoops, with us on the HRNP guest line. And, you know, I guess, Salman, one of the biggest takeaways from the Rockets' start so far is their half-court offense and half-court defense have been really efficient. I mean, they are plus 11 in half-court rating as of today. And, you know, for a team that has struggled in both of those departments, to see them plus 11, it's like, am I watching this? Is this the same franchise?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of two things. Like, one, like, Fred VanVleet coming in and being that table setter and him kind of recognizing that Şengün's the guy to run this offense, right? Like, it's not an offense to any of the other guys. Like, those guys are all talented in their own right. But in terms of being the engine, being the hub, being the guy who facilitates the offense, everything's been going through Şengün. And that's VanVleet coming in and recognizing, oh, he's like the most equipped guy to go do that. And he comes in, he runs a ton of pick and roll with him, runs a ton of dribble handoffs with him. And Şengün's really got the team rolling, not only from a passing perspective, but like his own scoring. He's been, you know, obviously he's always been an efficient scorer, but he's just had much more opportunities to do that with Ime Udoka and Fred VanVleet kind of running the show there at the point guard position. It's been kind of a treat to watch. I always thought Şengün was kind of more capable offensively than the Rockets were kind of utilizing him to be. And seeing him kind of used in this way as kind of this hub option, I mean, I think this is kind of like the natural fit for these guys, right? Like, Şengün runs the offense. Jalen Green's out there on the perimeter to provide you perimeter scoring, your attack from that angle. And everybody else kind of fills in the gaps. And I think that's kind of that should be enough to provide a good offense, you know, or at least a structured offense that makes sense to a lot of people.
Now, I love that Alpi's getting his hands on the ball more often. So many times you say, like, is he the best? Is Alpe the best player on the floor for them?
Oh, that's not a question. Yeah, he's clearly the best player on the Rockets right now. I think that conversation ended on, like, day three of the season for me. even the bits where he would come in off the bench or he would play with the bench units and just kind of dominate, like, it was becoming more and more evident the Rockets had to increase his usage, and they did. You know, in the games that followed, they bumped up his usage, and he was getting more and more touches with the basketball. And that's a credit to Ime, man. He's a straight shooter. You know, like, he's letting the guys who play the best get the ball. And I think that's people who are worried about Alpe kind of having kind of a minimized role with Ime, the way he was talking about it, like using him in dribble handoffs, like if Şengün was going to succeed with the dribble handoff stuff, he was going to be able to do much more. And that was always going to be the case with Ime. Like if it was always like, can you succeed in this role I give you? And then I'll give you more if you do. And that's exactly what Şengün's done. It's been a fair shake for all the players on the roster. And I don't know, I just think the Rockets are better when they take that kind of democratic approach.
He's Salman Ali, founder at Red Nation Hoops, covering the Houston Rockets. Follow him on X, Twitter, at Salman Ali NBA. Salman, always appreciate your time, my friend. We will talk again soon.
For sure. Thanks for having me on, Patrick.
All right, Salman Ali, Red Nation Hoops, with us on the HRNP guest line. Coming up next, we talk baseball with our man Bob Nightingale, USA Today, MLB Network Radio. He joins us next.
ESPN 97.5.com. Time to wake up.
Hey, you. Finally awake. You were trying to cross the border, right?
Late night Houston sports talk only happens here. It's Late Hits with Patrick Creighton. Presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph. Get Physical RX. By Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology. And by BetUS. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
Not only is our next guest a longtime baseball insider for USA Today and MLB Radio Network, but he also told all of you Justin Verlander was coming back to the Astros before it happened. He was the first one to say it. And he also single-handedly ended the most recent lockout. He's our buddy Bob Nightingale. What's going on, Bob? How are you?
We're doing great. How are yourself, Patrick?
Well, we're all waiting with bated breath. As you know, over the last hour, did something really cool happen, or was dinner just that good?
No, nothing really cool happened. No manager hirings yet. No trades. So, Astros will have somebody here next. Gotta be next 72 hours away. People talk about the GM meetings.
Now, is it strange to you the Astros haven't made a move yet? I mean, we've heard Dana Brown talk very glowingly about Joe Espada. It seemed like he was, quote, the manager in waiting. What's the holdup with the Astros and Espada? Are they looking for somebody else? Is this Jim Crane looking for somebody else? What's going on with the Astros and the managerial search?
Yeah, I mean, you heard, you know, that the Espada has Dana Brown has recommended him, but obviously, you know, it's been no hire. So they got to be looking around at someone, maybe seeing someone's available. So I don't think Espada was a manager in waiting. I still, you know, think he's a favorite to get the job, but it seems like they keep looking around and say, okay, can we do better?
Where would better be?
I don't know, you know, who would be. I'm not saying he's going to be a candidate, but, you know, do they start looking at a guy like a Benji Gill, you know, who's now, you know, Mexico president of the same license guy managing. Terrific guy, WBC, you know, things like that. So maybe someone, someone else's bench coach, you know, maybe they're looking around. Someone's staff, you know, with all these coaches now unemployed. You don't know. I mean, could they be looking at, you know, I'm just throwing this out there, you know, could they be looking at David Ross, you know, now that he's available?
Well, interesting, because I was just about to ask you about David Ross, because it certainly does look like David Ross got handed the short straw here, as the only reason he lost his job is because Craig Counsell decided he wanted to manage in Chicago. What was your opinion of David Ross as the manager of the Cubs? And, you know, what kind of manager do you think he is? Is he a guy that you'd look at and say, hey, this guy's a really good manager on the come? Not a lot was expected of the Cubs, but I think they had a pretty good representative season this year. What's your impression of David Ross?
Yeah, I thought he was fine. I mean, you know, you're going from player to manager without any, you know, coaching experience and minor league managerial experience. You know, yeah, that's fine. And they, you know, hit a wall there at the end of the season. You know, they lost, what, seven, eight games to the Diamondbacks. Diamondbacks go to the World Series, and the Cubs are sitting home. So, you know, I mean, obviously he's, you know, very upset, saying the right things so far to his local paper in Tallahassee, Florida. But, you know, that move angers some managers. You just don't take someone's job like that. You know, there was five other openings. You know, go somewhere else. You don't have to take a guy's job because he would have been managing if Counsell, you know, wasn't hired, you know, underneath him without him, you know, knowing, without anybody knowing a thing about it.
Was Counsell using the Mets as leverage, or were the Mets just not going to meet the asking price?
No, the money was no problem. He was going to get, you know, the money. He was going to get at least $5 million anywhere, which is still making the highest paying manager. I think he was using the Mets, maybe some other teams as well, as a stalking horse. And this is the guy that was talking about, you know, sitting out next year, just being around home and being around, got two daughters in high school, one boy at Michigan, one boy at Minnesota, and doing that. So, that's why I didn't think there was anywhere in the world he was going to go all the way to New York and leave his family behind. You know, this way, you know, he actually gets, you know, everything he wants. A team with a big budget, you know, his $8 million salary, and he pretty much gets to stay close, you know, stay home, just a 90-minute drive away.
Bob Nightingale, longtime baseball insider, USA Today, MLB Network Radio, with us on the HRMP guest line. Bob, the Angels decided they were going to go get an old-school manager in Ron Washington. And, you know, you look at the coaching staff that they're talking about putting together with Torrey Hunter and Chili Davis and Eric Young and Clint Hurdle. And it's, you know, it's kind of a who's who of coaches. I mean, you know, the three of those guys were really good baseball players. You know, Clint Hurdle, you know, was a backup catcher for a while. I mean, all these guys are known. Are the Angels looking at what the Rangers did last year and go and get a highly respected, the old school manager, and basically say, look, we're going to get the hell out of your way. We're going to let you do whatever you want. And the success that they had as a result, are they looking at that and trying to copy the recipe?
Yeah, I mean, I believe so. I mean, you look around and say, Dusty Baker went 2 years ago, like you said, Bochy. And I think they need someone in there to kind of restore order. You know, I mean, guys aren't playing. The big thing with Ron Washington was, hey, you post. You play every single day. And that hasn't happened in Anaheim. So I think they want, you know, some tough guy coming in. Great reputation. That's Ron Washington.
When you talk about that and you say, you know, how, you know, look, Ron Washington, look, he's an old coach. He's an old school guy. Bochy, old school guy. The Astros had Dusty, who's an old school guy for the last 4 years. Is there another guy like that that could be available? You know, Jim Crane likes bright, shiny things. James Click wanted to have that, you know, GM, manager, you know, coexistence like they had in Tampa. It seems like Dana kind of wants the same thing. Are they going to let Dana have that, or are they going to go with another, try to find a manager along the lines of Dusty who's going to push back on everything?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a GM wants a lot of say. Obviously, you know, Dusty Baker and Dana Brown butted heads a lot. You know, you try to go get a guy like a Jim Leland, talk him out of retirement. You know, I don't see that, but I didn't, you know, no one saw La Russa coming back out of retirement either. You know, that sort of thing. So, but yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Jim wants to go with, you know, everybody likes to have experience. You know, Brad Austin's name was out there for a long time. I don't think he's a strong candidate anymore. I'm not even sure he's a candidate. But it could be, you know, hey, you know, we know we can get a spot anytime we want. Let's keep looking around. Is there somebody else out there? You know, is it a Brian Bannister who used to manage the Texas Rangers, you know? John Gibbons lives in Texas, the former Blue Jays manager. So there's certainly guys out there.
So right now you don't think Brad Ausmus is a legitimate or serious candidate?
Yeah, I mean, it's only legitimate. I just, from what I understand, his name seems to have faded for whatever reason. You know, maybe because he's, you know, had two stints and, you know, wasn't successful in Detroit or Anaheim. But, yeah, I mean, for a while I thought, and I mean, that's a perfect choice because he was runner-up to Dusty Baker. He was runner-up to Dana Brown. So it could be a thing where they think he's more suited for the front office, you know, rather than, you know, on the field.
Bob, we heard Dana Brown talk about, you know, the Astros might not have a whole lot of financial flexibility. They're not considering outfield help as a primary objective for the offseason. They're kind of looking at bringing back Martin Maldonado as the backup catcher going forward. Well, they've got needs, you know, with the pitching staff, the starting pitching, certainly with the bullpen as they lost three arms. What do you expect the Astros to prioritize in the offseason?
You know, you got to get some more, you know, bullpen arms. It's always about. I think the team, you know, see now, will largely be the same. I don't think Maldonado will be back. I think he wants more playing time than just, you know, once or twice a week. He wants more responsibility than that. So I would think they go find their backup catcher and let Maldonado go. Otherwise, you know, you do need another outfielder, you know, with Brantley gone and certainly some bullpen pieces. But, you know, I think it'd be more of a bottom-type feeding there. You know, I don't see them going out and getting, you know, like a Josh Hader or something like that.
So you think they will be more bargain bin shopping than, you know, buying at the high-end store?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see them going in after, you know, say, Aaron Nola or something like that, or Yamamoto, you know, from Japan. But, yeah, I can see them, you know, getting, you know, like a guy like a Michael Wacha, you know, who was in San Diego. Those, you know, those type of guys, you know, the guys who, Wade Riley, who they had at one point, you know, those type of guys that kind of fill out the rotation.
The Astros have two very prominent players who will be free agents at the end of the 24 season in Jose Altuve and Alex Bregman. Do you expect one, both, to sign extensions in the offseason, or do you think one or both will wind up testing free agency?
I would think that both would test free agency, but I think Altuve stays there for the rest of his career. I mean, I think he was done playing. He's going to have some, you know, job, whatever he wants, in front office, you know, on the coaching staff, something. I think Altuve is there for the rest of his life. It's tough to afford him and a Bregman, but I think Altuve is a guy, and, you know, I would think that Bregman would go elsewhere. Just, you know, they're not going to pay, you know, that kind of money, you know, for two infielders, at least, you know. I know Texas Rangers did it. I don't see the Astros doing that. But, you know, they certainly favor Altuve over Bregman. You know, they want to make him an Astro for life.
You know, and we've seen the Astros with guys, you know, try to sign guys and buy out some years of their arbitration. They've done it with Yordan Alvarez. They've done it with Christian Javier. They have not been able to do so to this point with Kyle Tucker. Do they need to get a deal done with Kyle Tucker this offseason, or basically they're not going to get it done? So they weren't able to get it done with George Springer 2 years early, and then there wasn't a whole lot of conversation the next year. Same thing kind of happened with Carlos Correa. Is that kind of how the Astros just approach things. Either they're going to get it done here with, you know, 2 years left of arbitration, or it's just not going to get done.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the Orioles are better, the better your chances to get it done. Obviously, Tucker had a great regular season and did not have a good postseason. Yeah, we'll see what happens. If Tucker wants to get, you know, the going rate in the market, the top dollar, then I don't think they're going to sign him. If he's willing to bend here and say, you know what, I want to stay in Astro, I want to stay here for the next 5-6 years, then I think it's a possibility. But, you know, he's certainly going to make himself a lot of money. We'll see what happens. In the Astros, you know, traditionally, you know, haven't given out those big, you know, long-term contracts.
All right, I got to ask you about the Yankees, because they've made a lot of noise the last few days between hiring an analytics company to teach them about analytics, and you got the general manager talking, well, we don't do a lot of analytics, and, you know, that's not like almost like Brian Cashman pushing back that analytics are bad. What is going on in the Bronx?
Well, a lot of frustration. I mean, even, you know, you saw, you know, Hal Steinbrenner say, oh, we don't bunt enough. Apparently he wasn't happy when, Brian Cashman, you know, lashed out at reporters the other day. So we'll see. I mean, in the industry, you think that you hear stories that, okay, they're all in analytics. Obviously, Brian Cashman pushing back on that theory. But, you know, even people that work there said they're more analytic driven than they have been in the past, where before it was kind of old traditional scouting. So, you know, there's frustrations. They haven't won the World Series since 2009. You know, missing the playoffs with the second highest payroll in baseball is embarrassing to them. So I think next year's a big year for the whole organization, particularly Brian Cashman and the manager, Aaron Boone.
All right, Bob, final question for you. Shohei Ohtani, Dodgers or Field?
I mean, I would take the Field. I would take the Field, given the choice. That being said, I really do believe that the Dodgers are the favorite, and I think the runner-up favorite is the Angels. And we talked about him leaving. I'm not so sure about that. I'm very comfortable there. I mean, obviously, if the Angels didn't think they'd have a chance to keep him, they would train away last summer, and so they believe that possibility exists. So I don't think there's too many places you would go. Like I said, you know, Angels, Dodgers, Cubs seem like to be a wild card here. Texas Rangers could be a wild card. I'm not sure I believe any other team.
He's Bob Nightingale, longtime MLB insider, USA Today, MLB Network Radio, with us on the HRMP guest line. Follow him on X, Twitter, at B Nightingale. Bob, always a pleasure to talk with you. Always learn something when we do. Appreciate your time, my friend. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks so much, Patrick. Take care.
Thanks, Bob. Bob Nightingale, USA Today, MLB Network Radio, with us on the HRNP guest line. Before we hit the break, I'll tell you about my man, Dr. Ben Salento, Texas Sinus and Snoring. You know, 4 years ago, Dr. Ben changed my life. Why? Because I had a sinus infection that came up every other month for over 20 years. That sound insane? It is insane. Try living like that. Every other month, living on antibiotics. It sucked. And I had over a half dozen doctors in two different states tell me that's what my life was always going to be. It wasn't until I met Dr. Ben that I learned that there was another option, that there was a solution to this problem, not just living on the antibiotics roller coaster. Dr. Ben was able to identify the cause of this never-ending sinus infection. It turned out I had staph infection. I don't know how I got staph infection in my sinuses, but I had staph infection in my sinuses. And it was highly resistant to antibiotics, but never really went away. And all those years of having infection did a whole lot of damage to my sinuses. My airways were almost 94% blocked. Like, just walking down the hallway, people thought I was snoring because my airways were so blocked. And at nighttime, guess what? Yeah, I snored like a monster. Airways were all blocked up. Well, thanks to Dr. Ben, I don't have sinus issues anymore. He was able to take care of that for me by removing that staph infection, by doing a balloon sinuplasty to open up my airways so that I can breathe, by doing a septoplasty and fixing my deviated septum that I didn't even know I had. And now I breathe great. I sleep great. No more snoring. No more sinus infection. Not only that, but if you have sleep apnea and you want to get rid of that CPAP, or maybe you're not even using the CPAP, very dangerous, Dr. Ben Salento is one of the foremost doctors in the region on the Aspire implant to get rid of your sleep apnea for good. What are you waiting for? Take down this number, 346-413-9313, 346-413-9313, or go to TexasSinusAndSnoring.com, TexasSinusAndSnoring.com, and tell them I sent you by.
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5, Sweet Sassy Molassie.
Clever metaphors and catchphrases escape me, like a fat girl waving her trophy from the smell contest. Sweet Sassy Molassie, I'm trying my best here.
Late Night Houston Sports Talk only happens here. It's Late Hits with Patrick Crady. Presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph. Get Physical RX. By Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology. And by MedUS. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Crady.
So today is a very important day in the history of sports entertainment. It is the anniversary of one of the most notorious events in sports entertainment, the Montreal Screwjob. In fact, before the match happened, Bret Hart and Vince McMahon had a discussion on how they thought the match should end.
I got to just talk.
Right up this way, let me show you.
I never ever wanted to leave here with any kind of bad feeling, but this week has been a bad week for me. I feel kind of betrayed a little bit.
Well, I do too, a little bit. And again, all we're talking about really is Ted Turner. That's what's coming between you and me. That's all. Can't tell you how appreciative I will always be for everything you've done.
I didn't want to leave with any problems. I actually didn't want to leave at all. And then it's the point where there was no other choice but to go. The way this whole thing has been depicted, it's really hard for me as a hero here to come up short this weekend. What would you want to do today, then?
I'm open to anything.
I think what I'd like to do is get through today. I think tomorrow I should just go in and do my speech and forfeit the title. I think it allows me a chance to leave with my head up and leave in a nice way. I mean, I don't have to be Sean. We could have a schmoz or whatever you want.
I would think it'd be a run-in type thing. But,
yeah.
But I'm open to anything.
No, I think that's...
I'm open to anything. Like I said before, I'm determined this is going to wind up the right way.
Well, they didn't actually have an agreement. When Vince said he was open to anything, anything wound up going down in Montreal like this.
Watching this matchup, there's a backbreaker, and Michaels again finds himself in one hell of a lot of trouble. He's resilient, but how resilient is he? How much of this abuse can he take? How long can he stand it? Oh, Michaels just pulled the referee right in front of the hitman.
What about that?
Michaels pulled referee Earl Hebner right in front of Bret Hart. And I think Hart and the referee hit head.
Is that a disqualification?
It might be if he could get up and call it. And again, Michaels raking the face. What is... Look at this!
Oh, you're kidding me.
Michaels,
are you
going to try to beat Bret Hart with a sharpshooter? Yes, he is! Are you kidding me?
And that was it. Bret Hart screwed over by Vince McMahon, Triple H, and Shawn Michaels. That is one of the most famous moments in wrestling history ever. happened on this day in 1997. Thanks to Bob Nightingale, USA Today, MLB Network Radio, Sam Kahn, Jr. of The Athletic, Salman Ali, Red Nation, Hoops, my man Jay Sheff on the other side of the glass. Our texters, tweeters, and twitchers are back tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Until then, have a great night. It's time!
ESPN 97.5.com. We keep getting away with it.
He can't keep getting away with it.